Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Kathy Kiley, sitting in for our regular host, Jason McClure. Today, we're going to flip our usual script. Normally, this show is put together by students in Jason's class. They pick an important international issue, do a lot of research, and find reporters and other experts living and working elsewhere around the globe. Then, through the magic of digital technology, we bring them together for a virtual conversation in our studios. On this program, however, we're going to meet some homegrown reporters whom we sent overseas to bring back a real hometown story. With me in our studios at the Reynolds Journalism Institute are Mizzou journalism students Meg Cunningham and Savannah Rudisell. Along with them, Nathan Lawrence, the digital content director of KBIA. That's the NPR affiliate that our journalism school operates here in mid-Missouri, and it's where you can hear this program every Thursday at 6:30 p.m. Central and anytime by going to kbia.org. Last but not least, we have the station's news director, Ryan Femuliner. Meg, Savannah, Nathan, you recently got back from Stockholm, Sweden. Tell us why you were there, Meg, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm a senior studying convergence journalism with an emphasis in investigative reporting. And we just got back from Stockholm, where we were covering Dr. George Smith accepting the Nobel Prize. We basically went as a test run to figure out how we can collaborate more with the newsrooms on campus. So we were sharing content, working every day to kind of produce different pieces of the same story for every newsroom on campus.
And so how many platforms were you feeding to?
Primarily three, but anyone else who was affiliated with the school could pick up content as they saw fit. So we were working through KBIA, KOMU, and the Missourian. And then also things like Missouri Business Alert or other smaller newsrooms on campus could pick up things if they wanted to as well.
Savannah, how much sleep did you get while you were in Stockholm?
We got very little sleep. There was a 7-hour time difference between Stockholm and Columbia, which made doing live shots really fun. The day of the ceremony, Nathan and I were out on the street at 4 a.m. and 5 a.m. for our 9 and 10 o'clock newscasts. Which was a really different experience and one that I really enjoyed.
Ryan, I wanted to ask you, why did you think it was important to send folks over to Stockholm for this ceremony?
Sure. Well, so I always have to think with two hats, my newsroom hat and my student-focused hat. And from the newsroom perspective, it's a once-in-a-lifetime story, right? That a professor who did his work at the University of Missouri is going to be awarded the Nobel Prize for that work that was done here. It's unlikely that's going to happen again in my career anyway. And then there's also just this opportunity to be able to provide students with this opportunity to go and have this experience in an international setting, working shoulder to shoulder with journalists from the AP and from other international outlets, and just I knew there were resources for it. It's a win-win for the university to be able to send a team over there, and it's great for all the campus newsrooms, as we've been talking about, to have the story and own this story that none of the other local outlets are going to have in the same way. But then from the educator standpoint and from the journalism school standpoint, we're undergoing a very focused effort at having more collaborative workflows amongst the daily newsrooms and, Global Journalist, Missouri Business Alert, Vox Magazine. And this was an opportunity for us to test it in the wild and say, like, let's take this story that we're not going to cover otherwise. We're going to carry AP content. Nobody was going to send anyone to Stockholm. Let's take this high-value opportunity and just try some stuff and see what happens. And a lot of stuff went really well. A lot of stuff could have gone better. That's the nature of experimenting. And I think, so regardless, it was a success in just being able to try something like this and see how it would go.
So oftentimes when we're in the news business, we are reporting bad news. It's that's what makes news news a lot of times. It's not happy stuff, but it's things that we think our listeners or our readers or viewers need to know about. But talk about the decision to report some happy news and the kind of response you got from listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I've been comparing it to like when your local baseball team wins the World Series, right? Like, of course you're going to cover the parade, right? Like, it's a big deal. It's something that the community's still talking about. I know everywhere I went, I mean, I'll be at lunch with my wife and I'll hear just this table of 20-year-olds talking about the Nobel Prize. You know, it's like, that's an amazing thing. How often are they actually talking about who won the Nobel Prize this year? That's not a usual topic of conversation for 20-year-olds at Coley's. So I think it's kind of this interesting cultural moment that I think we should capture. And I think, you know, celebrate those moments. I know for us at KBIA, our listeners are very, I mean, coincidentally, George's son actually used to work at KBIA for a few years. And George and his wife, Margie, have been longtime listeners and supporters of KBIA. And so, you know, we have this kind of very interesting extra layer of excitement about this story. But it's also something, I mean, we even gave away mugs with George's face on them during the last pledge drive. It's just something that there's a lot of excitement about. And I think, why not give that coverage and, you know, and celebrate it? It is a celebration.
Nathan, what was the response? You went over there as our resident professional. What are some of the other news organizations that you found yourself shoulder to shoulder with? And what was the reaction in Stockholm when students from the Missouri School of Journalism came to cover this story?
So the interesting thing about the Nobels is that we think of them as this huge event, and they are, of course, a huge event, but for the press, it's actually a pretty small, insular group of people who come, and generally they're sort of divided into two camps. There's the major wire services like the AP and Reuters, and then there are the more local papers in the area, and those are basically the divide. And then, of course, SVT, the public television there in Scandinavia, is a big player in this sort of area. So there is a relatively small group of press who are at these events. One of the pictures that we keep flipping through here on the screen behind us is actually of the room where the big press conference for the sciences happened, and there may have been 25 people max at that. What do you think? Is that about right?
So you were interlopers in this.
We were a little bit, yeah.
And what was the reaction to that?
Well, I think there's a combination of things. I think one of the reactions that we got at first is that it was very cute, and you know that's a hard reaction to sort of discard. But we've also had people who are very impressed with like the skills of our students and who are very excited to help these students out and get them deep into the coverage. We had a lot of very unique opportunities, I think, because we were recognized as, locals from another place who were coming in and covering the story from a very local perspective. We got a lot of opportunities that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
I want to talk a little bit more about that after the break. I just want to remind people that this is Global Journalist, and on today's program, we're talking with members of a very special Missouri Journalism School reporting and production team. They organized our on-site coverage of ceremonies in Stockholm, Sweden, where Professor Emeritus George Smith received the first Nobel Prize ever awarded to a University of Missouri faculty member. So that must have been pretty exciting. Did you find yourselves, and again, sometimes when we're working as journalists, we have an adversarial relationship with our sources, but I think it was probably a little bit different for you, right? Tell me a little bit about how did you interact with Professor Smith and his family, and what was that like?
The Smith-Sable family was so accommodating to anything that we asked of them. They gave us a lot more access to them during this incredibly busy and crazy week for them than we could have ever expected. They were very generous with their time because we know they had a lot of demands on it.
And one of the pictures we're seeing here is of Professor Smith holding a little piggy bank or some kind of little oinker there. What is that all about? Can you tell us about what that picture is?
Which one of you two wants to take that one?
So he, part of the Nobel kind of procession is you bring along some artifacts that are tangentially related to your research. So that little piggy bank was kind of an inside joke from him and one of his postdoctoral fellows from inside the lab, just kind of that served as a memento of their time spent together researching phage display in the laboratory.
And he had a lot of his postdocs there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that must have been exciting. What was their reaction?
They were over the moon for him. A lot of them were very involved in the phage display research, which is why he brought them along. He often referred to them as more of family as opposed to postdocs or like former students. So they were so happy to be there. And every time we talked to them, all they could say was just how important George was to developing their scientific career, developing their methodology as scientists. So you could really tell how close they were. And to have them as sources was a really valuable perspective that we were able to kind of hone in on. And
so this is the academic equivalent of Dr. Smith's posse, huh?
Exactly, yeah.
And what was the age range? Do you get a sense of this is somebody who's had influence over generations?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing also George mentioned was when he was kind of going through his week, he had set up some lectures on local campuses where he could go back in and be in the classroom again. And we could really tell just from talking to him throughout the week that he really cared about, you know, influencing future scientists and focusing on education and kind of making sure that we give that same value to science as we do to maybe some other fields. So he was really interested in making sure that through future generations, an importance was placed on scientific research. And I think his postdoc fellows felt the same way.
So one of the challenges you had to master in doing this story was this is about some hardcore science. How did you as journalists prepare for that? And how did you, are there some tricks you had for translating what this all means to those of us who do not have Nobel laureates?
Well, Meg and I both broke out our old high school biology textbooks just to, I mean, first of all, we have to get into the middle of it and fully understand ourselves and then break it down for the people who have never taken a biology class post-high school.
Yes, we journalists do a term paper every day.
Yes. Exactly. So also what helped me too is comparing notes with Nathan and Meg as well into how they understood it, other resources that they had found too. And then I talked a little bit with Dr. Smith before we left just to verify everything that I had understood was exactly what he had meant too. Yeah.
And he places a significant emphasis on making sure that he can explain things for the common mind to understand.
Yes.
I mean, he's been talking about his research that he developed in 1985 for quite a while. So by now, he's kind of figured out how to break it down so we can all get a good grasp on it. And he did an incredible job of working with us on that as well.
Well, let's get into the other technical side of this story, and that's the journalism technical side. I can remember from my own experience having some pretty wacky things go wrong when you're overseas. So, and I see Nathan is just closing his eyes and shaking his head. So what was the worst thing that happened and how did you deal with it?
Well, so the one that, like, my most embarrassing thing is tipping a bellhop $50 by mistake. I mean, but everybody does that once.
So was this Swedish money or?
Yes,
was, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like that.
What happened at dinner later?
And then at dinner later, I accidentally left a 50-cent tip. So,
somewhere it evened out.
Yeah, I felt terrible about it, but that was, you know, one of the challenges, of course, is when you come to a place like that and you're a stranger to this place, and we learn. You know, at least I went out of my way to learn a lot of basic language about, like, asking questions like, where is this person, or how do I use the restroom here, or, like, saying things like, thank you so much. But that only gets you so far, you know, and everybody there, as a general rule, does speak English, but, you know, it's the respect thing, you know, and it's a barrier that you have to cross with some of the issues there. But there are also, you know, you are working without a net, you know, if you're here at the J school, and your camera breaks, you drive back to KOMU and you get a different one. If you're in Stockholm and your camera breaks, you got to figure out how you're going to explain in Swedish to a rental house, what camera you're going to get. That didn't happen to us, but boy, were we worried it would.
Sounds like one of those things you were worried about. Now, there was a travel glitch, right,
that resulted
in one of you soloing for a while, right, Meg? So tell us a little bit about that, and I think it gives people an idea of how journalists have to think on their feet, because bringing people the news requires a lot of behind-the-scenes things to work, and if they don't work, you're responsible for fixing them. So tell us about that experience.
Right. Well, I landed, and before my flight coming out of O'Hare, I got a call from Fritz that said, they're stuck, you're going solo. And I was like, okay, I've traveled internationally alone
before.
And this
is Fritz Kropp,
yes.
Our Associate Dean for Global Programs. Yes.
Exactly. And so, I got there. business as usual. I went to the hotel, tried to check in, I couldn't. So I had my two big bags with me from moving out of my apartment and going straight there.
So you had just moved out of Washington, D.C., where you've been an intern all summer.
Yes, yeah.
You had all your stuff, like a little turtle, everything on your back, okay? And you've flown overnight. You haven't had any sleep.
No, I did not sleep on the plane, despite my greatest efforts. So I go, I drop my stuff off at the hotel, and I'm like, okay, I'm just going to, after a short cry in the bathroom because I was so exhausted, I was like, I'm just going to walk around and get my bearings. I ended up at the Nobel Museum where I just ran in to Dr. Smith and his wife, Marjorie. So I was like, I just whipped out my phone and I was like, okay, let's do this. I didn't know what our coverage plan was going to be, but I knew since they were in front of me, I needed to get something, establish a scene because I know we were expecting content that day, despite the fact that we didn't have gear or people. And then I texted Ryan and I was like, okay, I just got these couple of bites from them. What do we do? So I ventured underground into this strange coffee shop and tried to connect to the Wi-Fi and just write up a short script just so we could get something out there and kind of get the groundwork laid down. The quality was horrible. I'm terribly embarrassed, but, you know, there's some things you can't work around.
But you made the first two deadlines. So we thought we had a team of three, and she still made her first two deadlines. And, I think any telling of how this goes should involve, like, me unexpectedly editing copy in my gym shorts on my couch at 5 a.m. bleary-eyed. But Meg still met those deadlines. And that, to me, the analogy I use for this, it's like I have a four-year-old and it's like I'm up in the attic and my four-year-old's in the basement. And it's like I know she knows what to do, but like I'm also not close enough to be able to help. But Meg still just let, you know, because Nathan and Savannah are in the air at this point. But Meg held it down, met these first deadlines with no gear. I mean, maybe you missed that, but the gear is with Nathan and Savannah on their plane. She's there with her phone and still manages to meet our first KBIA deadline and the first Missourian text deadline as well.
Which was an incredible start, too, because Nathan and I had just had delay after delay in St. Louis, a six-hour layover in Chicago, and then to land and hear that Meg has already completed two of our deadlines was a really, really great start to this team effort.
Yeah, luckily, because I've worked with KBI in the past, I knew, you know, kind of the radio writing. I knew Ryan was going to be awake because I was a morning news anchor. So that was like a comfort when I was just going through it because I was like, I know he's going to be up if I need to text him or need help. So, but yeah, I think just like having a prior knowledge of what we needed was super helpful because I could just, without a ton of brain power, sit down and like write out an easy radio script that just said, hey, we're here. This just happened. Stay tuned. So
that's why we practice,
exactly.
And that's why we hew to those formulas for writing, because there will be times when you're on desperate deadline or you're really, really tired, and it's nice to have that safety net to fall back on, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So did you have any misadventures, Savannah?
I did. We wanted to do, so we had live shots for the ceremony day on all four of our shows at KUMU, so we wanted to do a practice on Sunday at 5 p.m. just to make sure we could get that live shot up and everything would be taken just fine. So we tested our signal a couple times back at the station and everything was perfect, no problems. Every preparation that our engineers had done with our gear, just flawless. And so we get up and I have the producer in my ear and she goes, you look good, you sound good, we've got you just fine. 2 minutes before the show, I drop completely. No signal, nothing to do. And so I am alone at midnight on the streets of Stockholm, no longer able to hear anyone, no one's able to see me. So through some fancy footwork back at the station, I moved later in the show and I could get back up. And then I froze again in the middle of my shot. But so we finished that out, and then that kind of left us with, what are we going to do tomorrow? So just all it took was a quick location change, and we got better signal from another place. But it was definitely nerve-wracking to know that, you know, the big thing that we were really there for just might not air.
Wow. Yeah. So this is a reminder that you're tuned in to Global Journalist. I'm Kathy Kiley, sitting in for Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about covering the Nobel Prize ceremonies in Stockholm, Sweden, with some of the journalists who were there to see University of Missouri professor George Smith pick up the prestigious award. quite a different thing, I think, right, for people who are used to our democratic society to go in and see all the royal regalia. How did that strike you, and what's your most vivid memory coming out of this?
Yeah, on the night of the awards ceremony, that was a chance for the public to kind of line up for a glimpse of the king and queen. So we're standing outside. We unfortunately couldn't get credentialed to get into the ceremony. So we're standing outside. It's freezing cold, but all of these locals have come and they're gathered around the entryway to try to see, you know, the royal family go inside, which ended up being really great for us. It was a good chance for us to kind of rub shoulders with the locals and get a feel of how the ceremony has changed throughout the years, the cultural significance of it for Swedes themselves. And they were all enormously proud of Sweden's chance to kind of be on an international map. One man was like, you know, we're such a small country, sometimes we feel like we don't have a lot to show, but we do have the Nobels, which is, you know, one of the most highly sought after academic, you know, prizes that someone can achieve. So it was a really good chance for us to kind of get on the ground floor with that. And we ended up getting a really awesome source at that point. So yeah, even though we were kind of standing outside, freezing cold for an extended period of time, it was definitely worth it.
What stuck out to me most was watching the feed of the banquet after the ceremony and seeing Margie Sabel, Dr. Smith's wife, with diplomats, laureates, royals all around her, and her just almost holding court. She was just so comfortable, so in her element, talking with these royals as well. I know Dr. Smith was escorted by Crown Princess Victoria to the banquet, and it's still, you know, having, yeah, these are our Missouri folks.
Yeah, Marjorie was escorted by the Prime Minister, we later found out, and I mean, she was holding her own. She was like, oh, we just had so much fun, had such a good conversation about life, and, you know, they never even touched on science from what I could tell. So it's just fascinating to, like, see that from an outside view. Yeah.
Well, and Dr. Smith's a pretty informal guy, right? He likes to ride his bike to campus. Tell us a little bit, but he couldn't quite keep with the informality. Tell us about the attire.
We have a Nobel attire expert.
Okay, let's hear it.
Yeah, so for most of the events, he needed to be in a lounge suit, which was just your, you know, normal.
Yes, and what
your
to
suit.
Americans, I think that would mean something different than it does.
Yeah, Sweden, so right? just a suit.
That's what you lounge in Sweden. At, yes.
Absolutely, of course.
Your tie and your suit jacket.
You know,
yeah.
with the royals. He, for his lecture, told me beforehand he wanted to, like, go completely decked out in Missouri gear. Which he just ended up with a tie that was, you know, striped Mizzou regalia. But and then at the ceremonies, of course, you needed a floor-length gown if you were a woman. Men needed to show up in a tuxedo with a white tie and tails, with George, you know, equated to all of them looking like penguins. And I think he said, the women are our only color. Or you could show up in a national dress, which I did see a couple people going up the stairs in a national attire. But yeah, very, very formal. I think the Princess of Sweden was wearing a very ornate ball gown and a tiara, and, you know, George was just being escorted by her, and they were a wonderful pair. So,
and what was the ceremony itself like? Did you get a chance to go in, or were you watching that remotely?
We were watching that remotely as well. There were only 10 pool cameras that got to be credentialed. It was all very tight, very formal, you know. A lot of the ceremony procession tried to keep press as tucked away as possible, as just to not interfere with everything that was going on. So we did get to watch that, which was great to see the Smith-Sable family watching Dr. Smith accept the award as well. I know his son Bram, who worked at KBIA, has an incredible picture of Dr. Smith receiving the award, with just the warmest smile on his face afterwards, holding that on that grand stage.
The one of the our colleagues at KOMU mentioned that when one of you was doing a live shot, she had to say, you might want to tone the smile down a little bit. You look a little too excited. Was that you, Savannah?
That was me. Yeah. I got the note that my news director has seen lottery winners not look quite so happy compared to how I looked when we first got there, especially.
So even though you were exhausted, this was an exciting moment for you.
Oh, absolutely.
What does it's so funny to hear that, actually, yeah, about the first one, mm-hmm, because, like, that was miserable, that
was terrible.
Live shot.
It's just as cold there as it is here, right? So, yeah.
It was actually a couple degrees warmer almost all the time. Yeah.
But it gets darker a lot sooner and stays dark later, yes?
We only saw the sun like one time, I think, and we were all overjoyed about it. We were like, the sun is out!
Yeah. It's like the golden hours are right back to back, essentially. Yeah.
So tell us, what does this mean to you? Think about, what does it mean for your career to have been a student journalist reporting from a foreign capital? Savannah, you go first. What impact do you think it'll have on you?
Sure. It's overcoming some challenges I would have never had the opportunity to face anywhere else. Like I said, just everything technical, logistics-wise, that kind of thing. But just reporting on this kind of international event, it's something completely different. But the lessons that we learned from it can apply to every day reporting in Jefferson City.
Yeah, absolutely. I think because it was so high stakes, we had a lot of pressure on our shoulders, which is maybe something we don't get so much on campus. We were expected to deliver, you know, X amount of content every day, and we absolutely had to do that. So we were just really running, making sure we were meeting every single deadline. I don't think I'd ever worked on such tight deadlines in such a high stress, little sleep environment before. So it was really just another kind of challenge that I can put in the book and say, you know, I've been able to do these things on a daily basis for a week and deliver content repeatedly, which was super challenging but so fulfilling. I mean, it feels so good to walk away from a week like that knowing you worked your absolute hardest and did the absolute best you could and to be proud of the results, which is something that maybe sometimes not all journalists can look at something and be like, I'm happy with this. So we were usually able to do that, which is really satisfying.
Very quickly, Ryan, what about you? What do you take away from this week as a professor?
We've learned a lot about what this collaborative effort is going to be like for the newsrooms. I mean, it's fantastic that they were able to have this experience, and I think everything they said is correct, that it's going to be very beneficial for their careers and just learning from the experiences that you've had. But for us as a university, we learned a lot about what these kind of collaborative efforts take to succeed, what some of the fail points are, and it's just going to make our efforts better. And we very overtly want to make our students prepared to collaborate out in the world. That's the whole reason we're making this effort at our university, because I think that's largely the future of journalism, actually, is collaborative.
Thank you so much. We are out of time for this edition of Global Journalist. We could talk war stories forever. This is a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to today's guests, Ryan Fumuliner, Nathan Lawrence, Meg Cunningham, and Samantha Rudisell. And many thanks, too, to several others who made this experience possible. The Mizzou J School's Office of Global Programs, the University's News Bureau, the Missouri Alumni Association's Legacy Fund, and, of course, Professor George Smith, for his smarts for winning the Nobel and his generous support of the students in the work of the Missouri School of Journalism. Aaron Hay is our audio engineer. Travis McMillan is our director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Kathy Kiley. Thank you.